Any takers? All right. Before we get started, Ryan, would you lead us in a word of prayer? So we'll be picking up in John chapter 4 and verse 43. We still had one last section left from lesson 5. And then I sent out lesson 6, which were the questions that Oren had prepared, which covers through chapter 5. And if it all works out, I would like to get through chapter 5 so that Oren can start fresh with chapter 6 next week, but you know, he may need to review things that I missed as well, so I don't know what he's going to do next week. So picking up with our story with Jesus, we had just seen him. We talked last week about him talking with the Samaritans, starting with the woman at the well, while he was passing from Judea going back up to Galilee. He had been in Jerusalem for the Passover that we saw at the end of chapter 2. And it seems he was there for the Passover, talked to Nicodemus, probably there in Jerusalem, and then was in the land of Judea, that surrounding region, around the Jordan River, baptizing and teaching there. And now he's making his way up back up to Galilee and passes through Samaria. So anyway, so I'm going to finish out reading chapter 4. Now after the 2 days, he departed from there and went to Galilee. For Jesus himself testified that a prophet has no honor in his own country. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things he did in Jerusalem at the feast, for they also had gone to the feast. So Jesus came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went to him and implored him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Then Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe." The nobleman said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go your way. Your son lives." So the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and he went his way. And as he was now going down, his servants met him and told him, saying, "Your son lives." Then he inquired of them the hour when he got better. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him." So the father knew that it was the same hour in which Jesus said to him, "Your son lives." And he himself believed in his whole household. This again is the second sign Jesus did when he had come out of Judea into Galilee. Okay, so Oren's question here is, why does Jesus make a seemingly negative statement about signs and wonders and then tell the official that his son had been healed? What's this game Jesus is playing here? Why does Jesus seemingly make a negative statement about signs and wonders and then tell the official that his son had been healed? Is he kind of, I don't know, having a double mind here or something like that? Travis?
I don't think he's having a double mind. I don't want to overthink it, I don't want to underthink it, but there are occasions where he gets exhausted with just the knowledge that people have of him and the lack of belief that they have, that they have to see something to produce faith, because they, at this point, they've known about some of the things that he's done. So I don't know. I think we see that sometimes when he interacts with his own disciples, he's humanly disgruntled with their lack of understanding, their lack of faith. So that's part of it, I think. But I thought, you know, maybe emphasizing the importance of belief based on the things that had already been done, rather than show us another sign, show us another sign.
Yeah, so Jesus has been disgruntled at people who don't believe who he believes should believe, especially. What clues in the context here tell us that Jesus might have been a little more disgruntled in this particular time than he might have been at other times? Right? Yeah, so he'd already performed a miracle here, that sign in Cana when he turned water into wine. The other thing that's mentioned here is that he had previously testified, which I don't believe was in John's account, but I know like Luke makes a big point about it, that a prophet has no honor in his own country. And so... This transition from being in Judea, being in Samaria, now going back to Galilee, where he grew up, is kind of a big deal here, that the Galileans tend not to see Jesus with the light that they ought to, because they see him as the carpenter's son. They don't see him for who he really is. Yes, Emily.
In 45, it also said that the Galileans welcomed him because they see what he's done in Jerusalem and the miracles there. So it seems like they're welcoming him because of what a sign he's seen. And I think he wants to know if this man would trust him without seeing the sign.
Yeah, so that's another good point, that a lot of them had been in Jerusalem. They're just back in Galilee. Just because they're from Galilee doesn't mean they hadn't seen the stuff that he did in Jerusalem, since they'd all gone to the Passover. But your point about him trusting Jesus without seeing the sign. And so that's a real key difference of this particular miracle. Whereas the miracle in Cana, you know, everybody kind of saw it right away. This is one where Jesus says, hey, look, your child's alive. You know, go home. And does anybody know? So the noblemen had come from Capernaum to Galilee, or sorry, to Cana. Does anybody know how far apart those two cities were?
16 miles.
Yeah, 16 miles. So we're talking about like a day's journey. I mean, this was a trek for him to come down and even find Jesus, and then to depart not really knowing for certain whether the miracle had actually been performed is another level to this belief that he needed to have. Levi?
Are people saying that he's kind of ragging on this guy?
I'm not sure that he's necessarily ragging on this guy. I don't know if I would describe it that way. Yeah, especially early on in the ministry, like these signs and wonders were how he had gained that initial belief. I wouldn't say that he's upset or mad at them for believing, but he seems to be perhaps a little frustrated here, maybe trying to just emphasize a point is probably the bigger thing that I would say that he's doing here, is that they need to see these signs and wonders in order to believe. And with the nobleman, I think we're seeing him call out something a little different, where it says that he believes Jesus' word when Jesus says, "Go your way, your son lives." It says, so the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and he went his way. That there's a distinguishing characteristic that he's now believed in Jesus based off of his word, not based off of seeing another sign. Does that help, Mason?
I agree that that is the whole theme about seeing signs, and I don't remember how much it's emphasized with Nicodemus. He came and complimented, "Oh, no one can do the signs you can do," but you could tell his faith was not what it should be. I think about the case in Mark where Jesus tells the lady, the Gentile woman, after she asks,
I think that we're challenging or trying to draw it out from them is probably a good way to think about that. And notice, sorry, go ahead, Emily. Yep, using just his just his word, and that's something that he's. As we go through the book, I think you'll see that being established more and more, that his word is good enough as it is proved out. I just wanted to notice another thing about the belief that this nobleman has, and that is when he goes back to the house. He discovers that his son has been cured, and he consults with those that are in the house as to what time did he get better. You know, he's trying to confirm, and he's trying to reconcile this with what he knew about what Jesus was doing, and he realized that, oh, it was the same hour that I was talking to Jesus that my son was healed. And then he himself believed in his whole household, is what it says. So what does that mean? Didn't he already believe Jesus? Why does John have to say that again? Yeah, so we've got an extra level to it. Not only is he seeing the past understanding the past signs, he's believing the future signs, and then when he sees that confirmed, like, that deepens his faith. And I think that's why it's emphasized again, that he believes something even deeper with that confirmation. Yeah, that's a really good point. Back in verse 42, they said to the woman, the Samaritan said to the woman, "Now we believe not because of what you said, for we ourselves have heard him, and we know that he is indeed, this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world." That they believed her to some extent in order to bring them out there, and now they believe Jesus because they've actually had that firsthand encounter with him. Yeah. Any other stuff on chapter 4, Levi? Well, we don't see Nicodemus' reaction to what Jesus was just telling him. It is a little difficult to judge what's going on. It just kind of cuts off the story at Jesus teaching instead of focusing on his reaction to that. All right. Let's move on to chapter 5. I'm not sure that I'm going to get through this. Should have known better. Let's see. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there was in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having 5 porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first, after the stirring of the water, was made well of whatever disease he had. Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity of 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Rise, take your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed and walked. And that day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed." And he said to them, "He who made me well said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" Then they asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you." All right. So for this particular miracle, we have some diseased people that are sitting by a pool, and Jesus happens to pick one out. Not really sure why he picked this man out in particular. Maybe because he recognized that, you know, he maybe had the least hope of others that were around there. And what's maybe something different or unique that you noticed about this particular miracle that Jesus performs? Yeah, so Jesus approaches him as opposed to having somebody come and approach him and ask for something. I guess the publicity of the miracles has been maybe not Jesus initiated, but I think it's the ones that we read about in John anyway. But it seems that word has spread after the fact. I don't know how many people would have been around here, but certainly we see that this man gets caught immediately by the Jews and recognized for what he's doing. It's also a Sabbath miracle. I think maybe that's the more key part about this that really becomes the emphasis and what is really going to drive some of the discussion in the latter part of the chapter. So what was the big deal about the Sabbath? Why were the Jews so up in arms about... well, what were they up in arms about? Yeah. I take it. I take it from the context that they probably did recognize him as being a man that had been lying there for 38 years. I can't imagine that would have escaped their knowledge, but yeah, they're so focused on him carrying his bed. And why was that so distressing to them? Yeah. And there certainly are some examples. I think it's Exodus chapter 31. That's not what I was thinking of. Oh, it was Numbers 15, I think, where a man was put to death for having picked up sticks on the Sabbath day. And so there were some examples of things where maybe at first glance you may have... Well, that's not it. Sorry, I got my references mixed up. There were some examples, and it had been talked about in the Old Testament about some of the violations that they had of the Sabbath and how God cared about them maintaining the Sabbath. And why was God so concerned about the Jews maintaining the Sabbath and keeping that holy? I don't want to get into a long dissertation on the Sabbath, but just to make sure we all have this context in mind as to why they're so concerned about this.
Honoring God.
Yeah, it was meant to be a blessing from God. He created the world. He mentions that in the Ten Commandments, that he had created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, and thus sanctified that seventh day for rest. And he was blessing his people by having them participate in that rest. And so he did not want them to treat that day as unholy. Certainly the Jews had a lot of specific regulations that they had created. And in their determination of what is working on the Sabbath versus what is resting and trying to distinguish those two things. And carrying a bed happens to fall under the you're laboring on the Sabbath. What was Jesus trying to get them to see with this? Yeah, trying to teach something about God. Maybe reading the next section here is actually I'm going to read the next couple verses. So the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. So what was Jesus, in Jesus' mind, what was he doing on the Sabbath day? The will of the Father. He was working. He was doing the works of the Father. I think it's a really intentional play on words there, that Jesus is saying, he's kind of saying outright, which isn't really brought up here, but he's kind of saying outright, look, I was working on the Sabbath because my Father's been working and I'm working. And you can be all uptight about that. Let me give you something else to be uptight about. What else does he claim here? Equality with God. And they understood that. I mean, that's what Jesus... his next dissertation here, he's going to... we're going to talk about that a little more. But he is saying that what he's doing, the works that he's doing, are the works that God is doing, and thus having that equality with God. Now, what was the work of God besides making this sick man well? What was the work of God that Jesus was ultimately trying to accomplish with him? That he talks about with this man.
Sin no more.
Yeah, he tells him to sin no more. Why does he tell him to sin no more? No, I mean in the text, like what reason does he give to tell them to sin no more? Yeah, and so this is where we get to this bigger message that Jesus is teaching. Look, I cured you of this infirmity, and that was bad. Like, you suffered for 38 years with this infirmity. But I'm telling you, go and sin no more, lest something worse happens. What Jesus is really trying to establish, is that he can heal things that are much worse than an infirmity. 38 years. He's healing the problems of sin. Right. And it's something that, things beyond this life, it's something that he's going to be continuing to build up as we go through the book. I think we've gotten some snippets of it, especially with the discussion with Nicodemus and with the woman at the well, and we're continuing to build more and more, but introducing these concepts to help them understand a much broader picture of what he's here to accomplish. And so when we get to this belief that he's calling people to have, it's one thing to believe that he can heal the infirmity, but he's trying to take them to the next step of believing that he can heal them from the infirmity of sin. Levi? Yeah, and this accepting, or their failure to accept this man, really stems from their disbelief in Jesus himself. Recognizing Jesus is the one with the power, and that's really the message that we should be getting through this story, is that Jesus is the one with the power. He's the one doing the work, and it's the belief in him is something the Jews don't have, and that's why they're skeptical of him, because they don't really trust what it is that he's doing and what the great things that he is accomplishing in the weak. Probably because they are not in that weak state, or they don't see themselves in that weak state, hinders their ability to believe in Jesus and to put that dependence on him. All right, I'm going to move on to the next section. I'll read verses 19 through 30. Then Jesus answered and said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he sees the Father do. For whatever he does, the Son also does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son, and shows him all things that he himself does. And he will show him greater works than these, that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son, that all should honor the Son just as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life and shall not come into judgment, but is passed from death into life. Most assuredly, I say to you, the hour is coming and now is when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted to the Son to have life in himself, and has given him authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. I can of myself do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is righteous, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of the Father who sent me. All right, so what's Jesus saying here? Maybe just first off.
Like you said with the work, where he's like, with the, hey, you're working on Sabbath, he's like, that's right, I'm working. That the concern about his, that, hey, he sounds like he's saying he's God. Like, he's removing all doubt. He's equal to the Father.
Yeah, no doubt he's equal to the Father. The Father is showing him greater works than even the stuff that they've seen. When he talks about the Father raising the dead and giving life to them, he's like, the Son gives life to whom he will. So, you know, God's raising people from the dead. You guys know that. You know, I'm giving life in that resurrection to whom I will. And then he even goes a step further. How does Jesus... guys are probably going to get me in trouble for saying this, but how does Jesus in some ways maybe seem to exalt himself even over the Father in a way? The judgment. He says that the Father judges no one but has committed all judgment to the Son. So he's, I mean, if it was one thing for him to be equal with God, now he's put himself at a part where, look, I've got more authority in a way here, that he's going to be doing the judgment. The Father has committed that to him. He's given him that responsibility, that great responsibility there. Yeah, I didn't want it. That's why I didn't want you guys to like take too much into that, because he's not exalting himself over the Father, but he's saying that the Father has, like, delegated is a good term to use. That the Father has kind of separated this out and saying, look, I'm not touching the judgment. I'm giving that judgment all to the Son, and that's it's a huge statement for him to make. Is really the thing that I'm saying with the amount of control that Jesus is claiming here for himself. Claiming that the Father has passed this authority of judgment onto him. But the purpose for that is so that everyone will honor the Son the same way that they honor the Father. So it's not that he's getting more honor, but he is getting this responsibility, this huge responsibility, delegated to him. Yeah, and so I mean, he talks about then the end times there. Yeah, don't marvel at this. I'm telling you what's going to happen. But everyone is going to be raised, and you're either going to be raised to a resurrection that leads to life, or one that leads to condemnation, and it's not, well, it's something that's in the hands of Jesus, really, as to who goes into the resurrection of life and who goes into the resurrection of condemnation. And Jesus calls his judgment to be righteous in this matter. Why does he say that it's righteous? In verse 30, Jesus calls his judgment righteous. What makes his judgment righteous? Right. So he's not seeking his own will, but he's seeking the will of the Father who sent him. And so when we're talking about belief in Jesus, like encapsulating the entire embodiment of Jesus being an authority, is trusting that his judgment is righteous. What he's choosing to do in order to heal certain people, in order to pardon certain people, it's all righteous judgment because he's doing the will of the Father. And so Jesus is making a lot of claims here, and so we may not have time to discuss all this, but I'm going to read the rest of the chapter talking about how he can make these claims. If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. There is another who bears witness of me, and I know that the witness which he witnesses of me is true. You have sent to John, and he has borne witness to the truth. Yet I do not receive testimony from man, but I say these things that you may be saved. He was the burning and shining lamp, and you are willing for a time to rejoice in his light. But I have a greater witness than John's. For the works which the Father has given to me to finish, the very works that I do, bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. And the Father himself who sent me has testified of me. You have neither heard his voice at any time nor seen his form, but you do not have his word abiding in you, because whom he sent, him you do not believe. You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and these are they which testify of me. But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. I do not receive honor from men, but I know you, that you do not have the love of God in you. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you'll receive. How can you believe? How can you believe who receive honor from one another and do not seek the honor that comes from the only God? Do not think that I shall accuse you to the Father, for there is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you had believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Okay, so Jesus says, you know, I can say all these things, but if I claim all these things about myself, it doesn't mean anything. Because you can't testify of your own self. Who's testifying of Jesus to back him up? We got several sources that he points out here. So John the Baptist came before. The Father? Moses? He mentions the scriptures in general, but Moses in particular he calls out. His works themselves. So John the Baptist, you had somebody that they did trust, regardless of whether they had reason to trust him or not. They trusted him. And so Jesus can point to him and say, look, if you trusted him, why don't you trust in me, that who followed after him? The works that he was doing, you know, if he's claiming to be the Son of God, and yet he's not performing the works of God, or he's not obeying the will of God, you know, you're not going to believe that person who's trying to claim that. The scriptures, especially Moses, I did want to call out there, because there were there have been at least three occasions so far in the book of John that he's referenced Moses and the testimony that Moses has given. Do we got time for that? I've been cut off. All right, keep in mind. So for next week, you can surprise Oren by being ready with these, at least three. There may be more. Maybe we missed some. But there are three references to how Moses testified of Jesus that John has already referenced in his gospel up to this point. All right. Thank you for your attention.